All right, hello everybody. Seeing as the recording has started, I'm going to kick us off with some housekeeping rules for today's training. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 2. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. We did have a session one on this training topic last week, and the archive is available on the CLUIN website as described on the PowerPoint slide here. If you missed session one, feel free to check the archive out at your earliest convenience. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, also known as the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping rules for today while we're in Zoom. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides available for you to download under Download Training Materials. You can use the Q&A pod at any time during today's training to ask any questions for our trainers, report any technical difficulties, or provide any comments that you may have. We will have three question and answer breaks during today's training. The first about 1:49, with the second at about 2:30, and the third and final one at the end, just about 2:55 p.m. So you'll have plenty of opportunities to ask questions and have our trainers answer them live. If we do not have enough time to answer all of the questions live, our trainers will respond via the Q&A pod. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form and click the box to certify that you participated, you'll be emailed a certificate shortly thereafter. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website to learn more about our current teams and how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that policy and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. With that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers joining us today for session two of vapor intrusion mitigation. All of them served as team members for the VIM team and have volunteered to support the training over the years. So with that, on slide five, I have the pleasure of handing off to Kelly Johnson from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality to orient for us for our training today.
Awesome. Thank you, Devin.
Thank you, Devin.
Again, as Devin said, my name is Kelly Johnson. I'm with the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, and I act as the Brownfields Vapor Intrusion Specialist. Welcome to session two here. Today, we're going to cover three really important topics for the modules. We've got active mitigation, passive mitigation, and system verification, and OM&M and exit strategies. There it goes. Some stuff you should learn today in session two here. We'll give a real brief background on the vapor intrusion mitigation training team. We'll give you an overview of the available documentation. We'll talk about how to access these mitigation strategies, and we'll identify the sections that'll be discussed. In the bottom right of this slide here is the URL web link there. You can't click it, but type it into your browser or navigate to ITRC. I highly encourage you to have that up during this session. Once you get to that web page, you'll see this figure here on the right, and it's actually a clickable figure. So where you see fact sheet or checklist or some of the other items like indoor air, treatment, things like that. You can click those and it'll take you straight to that technology information sheet or fact sheet. And then if you scroll back to the top of that web page, you'll be able to get back to this main page here. And so I highly encourage you to have that up during this talk so you can become familiar with where they are and also look at the info. And again, and here we've got the interactive directory. That's the thing on the right there. As part of the mitigation team, we developed a bunch of fact sheets. There's technology information sheets that'll go more in depth into topics, and they're all designed to be pretty quick, especially the technology information sheets, to be able to get up to speed very quickly. There's a really good flowchart for the vapor intrusion conceptual site model development that's covered in session one, and you can get to those recordings. And you can also go to the conceptual site model fact sheet there and get to it. And it's a little complex, but it has a lot of really good information on it, especially as you're trying to figure out what technologies to select and things. There's also the considerations and impacts of the various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. There's a number of checklists that you're encouraged to take and take back to your regulatory agency or company and modify as needed. And then there's additional information. Again, we're not going to go through a full VI 101. We're kind of assuming that you're at least somewhat up to speed if you're here talking about mitigation. But just to make sure everybody's on the same solid ground, a reminder about vapor intrusion. Vapor intrusion occurs when contaminants in soil and groundwater volatilize into soil gas. And vapor intrusion itself occurs when these vapors migrate into the overlying buildings and contaminate indoor air. And of course, the main risk is that poses a threat to the indoor, to the occupants. And there's two main kinds of vapor intrusion. There's chlorinated vapor intrusion, which addresses the chlorinated compounds, and petroleum vapor intrusion. That's a subset of VI that deals exclusively with the petroleum hydrocarbon contaminants. There's a lot of common features between the two, but you might tackle the problem a little differently depending on what your main contaminant is. And vapor intrusion mitigation itself, you implement that to reduce indoor air contaminants that are due to vapor intrusion. That's a very important part there, below applicable action or screening levels and to protect public health. And VI mitigation can be accomplished by either modifying the vapor intrusion pathway to reduce the max flux of contaminants entering the building. And this, and also by reducing indoor air contaminant concentrations by removal or dilution. And removal would be rerouting the soil gas around the structure. Dilution could be something like adding additional makeup air or diffusion, where you would add a vapor barrier or something like that. So vapor VI mitigation or vapor control. Volatile organic compound, VOC vapor, can include source remediation, which is where you address the source of the vapor where they're generated. And remediation technologies are covered in session one, by the way. Active or passive mitigation, which is where you address, which occurs at the building envelope and at the interface between the building and the subsurface. And that'll be one of the topics here coming up. Rapid response, which is mostly addresses indoor air and buys you time so that you can have more long-term solutions in place, like active or passive mitigation. And lastly, institutional controls. And these place legal or regulatory requirements on the property to protect public health. And they can include a number of things, such as maybe if you build a building, you have to have a VI mitigation system or things like that. This is just a really quick overview of the steps in the vapor intrusion mitigation process. This will get covered more in depth and with more details coming up here in the next modules. But to kind of get the framework started here and some of the important things to keep in mind, as part of the mitigation process, there's a pre-system installation. And that could have the assessment of site conditions. That could be making sure your conceptual site model's sufficient. Technology selection to make sure that you're picking the right thing to address the site contaminants and to protect public health, and develop and document the system design. And depending on your regulatory agency, that might include submitting a design for review and approval and things like that. Once you get past the pre-system installation, you get to the actual installation components. Number four there is the pre-construction meeting, and that cannot be stressed enough. You've got to make sure that everybody on a job site understands the importance of the VI mitigation system that you're putting in. If you have a plumber come on later that doesn't understand what any of the piping is, and they just pull it out because it's not on their specific plans and it might look like plumbing, which has happened plenty of times, you can imagine that that causes a lot of issues and costs a lot of money too at the end of the day. There's the actual installation of the system and installation oversight, which is also incredibly important to make sure that no component of your mitigation system is covered before you get a chance to inspect it to make sure and verify and document. Once all said and done, and in a number of cases, especially if it's a new building before you occupy, you've got the post-system installation components. That can include system verification, where you might do additional inspections. Verification sampling could be subslab or indoor air, and confirming performance QA/QC, which could be things like checking depressurization, pilot testing, and things like that. There's documentation, which is where you would document the final install. If depending on your regulatory agency, you might have to submit a final report with all the as-builts and your opinion if it's safe for public health and things like that. For review and approval. And then there's long-term stewardship of it, which includes the operation, maintenance, and monitoring. And so with that, it's my pleasure to hand it off here for the active mitigation approaches. And I believe it's to Catherine. Thank you.
Yep, that's me. Thanks. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks everybody for joining. Let's make sure I can use my mouse here. I'm going to be going through the module about active mitigation approaches. And let me just put the next slide here. So we're going to talk about the active mitigation approaches that we discussed as part of our ITRC VI mitigation team. And we were really focusing on a very wide audience of professionals with varying degrees of familiarity with VI and VI mitigation. And we really wanted to focus also particularly on state and federal regulators that are tasked with reviewing these designs, reviewing these active mitigation approaches, and being able to help projects move through the project cycle. So trying to give you some tools and information to be able to make some good decisions about VI mitigation projects, be able to ask good questions to the project team, and so on. So the objectives of this specific module, first you want to go through a definition of active mitigation, just so we're all on the same page, because there could be some minor variations on what that means to be an active mitigation system. We're going to go through a few of the most common types of active mitigation. And then from there, we'll go through a few of the more important design considerations when you go through the VI mitigation design process. There's way more information on those in our ITRC documents, but we want to highlight a few today for you so you can get started. So first, what is active mitigation? So what we used as our definition is a continuous diversion of vapors from under the building to the atmosphere using a mechanical means like a fan or blower. And really that, that mechanical means is the key to make these systems active, and specifically a mechanical means that is for this purpose. So if you're increasing your HVAC system in your building to help increase dilution, the way we were defining it, that was not an active mitigation approach. Active is using a fan or blower for this process of diverging vapors from under the slab and then out into the atmosphere. And the other part is that there's some quantifiable physical measurements, and some of them are listed here on the slide, and that these can be measured so that you can easily determine if the system is being effective. So we've got some listed here, and there might be some other methods that you use, but these are some of the more common ones. So the first stop on our document map that Kelly showed earlier that has to do with active mitigation approaches is our active mitigation fact sheet. So this is just a quick little picture of what that fact sheet looks like. It is a summary guide. So it has information in it summarizing some of the more common approaches that we'll talk about in a second. And it also has some quick summaries of ones that are active mitigation, a little bit less common, but we wanted to give you some information on what those might look like. And throughout the whole fact sheet, there is several active links to different types of references, either one of our previous ITRC documents that might have some more information on a particular mitigation approach, or you'll see a lot of active links to ANSI AIRST, which has a set of standards that you might be interested in if you're looking for really specific design components for a VI mitigation system that's active. There we go. Okay, so we want to dive straight into the technology information sheets, or tech sheets that we called them. And these we developed for our top four common active mitigation approaches. And these tech sheets are all written in a similar fashion, so they should be easy to move from one to the other. They each have a general design section, a component section, some pros and cons or pros and limitations to that particular technology. And we also did put in some general cost implications that were at least accurate to the 2020-2021 timeframe, but they're in there to give you a sense of what some of the cost implications could be. And sometimes there's also a section about some special considerations that are particular to that technology. So our most common, our most conservative, our most usually most cost-effective way to mitigate VI with an active approach is a subslab depressurization system. So we have a tech sheet on that type of system. And you can see here, it's very similar to that first picture I showed where you're collecting vapors from underneath the building and you're drying them out with a fan and releasing them out in the atmosphere. You can see in these two pictures, actually the fan can be in multiple different places, but the important piece about the fan is that it is outside of the occupiable building envelope. So if you're looking to turn that attic into your next home office, then you'd have to do something different in order to have that fan be outside of your occupiable building envelope, outside your insulation. Other things that we usually do with subslab depressurization is we'll combine it with other approaches like ceiling cracks or ceiling penetrations. And oftentimes this particular mitigation approach is for existing buildings, or most commonly for existing buildings. But in the next slide, I'm going to go over how it can also be used in for new buildings during construction. So it can be used for both. So before I go through new construction, the components, very general components of a subslab depressurization system, and you'll see these components generally repeated through all of the active mitigation approaches because they do apply. We have some sort of fan or blower. We have suction points, or maybe some perforated piping. We have our vent piping and our valves, and we have some sort of measurement equipment, whether it's a manometer or a gauge or a sensor or all three. Those are the typical components. And we do have some optional ones listed here because in some states it may require you to do some emission controls. You may need to consider condensate, whether it be through a knockout tank or some bypass of the fan. So some other components that are more site-specific or state-specific. And I don't have the advantages and limitations for this listed on the slides here, but you can certainly read about them in the tech sheet. So specifically active mitigation in subslab depressurization and new construction, the key difference for new construction is that you hopefully have a lot of control over what that subgrade material is going to be under your building. So that will inherently allow you to have more transmissivity. Your system can be more effective and reach a wider area with less energy if you have control over the material that air is moving through. Oftentimes in new construction, it is also combined with a vapor membrane, sometimes you can use a thicker membrane if you're hoping to maybe not turn that system on, or if you know the system's going to go on, perhaps you use a thinner membrane because you know the active part of the system is going to help mitigate your vapor intrusion issue. So in that way, you know, the active system may just be roughed in to a building and then you decide later if it's turned on or not. And really that means that you have a little bit more of a cost-effective situation if you're able to put the system in a new building versus having to put it in later. You have, you know, lower costs if you're doing during construction than if you're doing it after construction. And you also have a lot more control over where the pipes go, a utility chase that they can go in. And you have the benefit of doing it before anybody lives there or anybody works there, which can certainly reduce the amount of interaction or disruption of the people who are working in the building. So I want to move on next to the second most common active mitigation approach, which we call subslab venting. And really, subslab venting and subslab depressurization are not that much different, but they're different enough that we wanted to call your attention to them. The difference here for subslab venting is that you can see sort of in this picture, you are still drawing out air from underneath the slab of the building and releasing it out in the atmosphere. But in this case, that space where you're pulling out the air from is either highly permeable gravel, or in this picture, it's a complete void space. So the idea for subslab venting is that you're not necessarily depressurizing the indoor airspace versus the subslab space. You're actually pulling air out, which is reducing the concentrations in that subslab space. And that is what is ultimately mitigating vapor intrusion. Oftentimes, you're kind of having a combination of both subslab venting and depressurization, but we've split them up in these tech sheets to illustrate the differences. So one thing to note about subslab venting is that since it's a lot easier for the air to come out from underneath the building, underneath the slab, and you have that dilution happening either through just natural leaking, or maybe you even have a on purpose dilution air way for air to get underneath the building, you're maybe not creating as much vacuum, as much differential pressure as you would in a subslab depressurization system. So you may need to think about performance measurements that are a little bit different than what you would use for a subslab depressurization system. And some of those are listed here, like mass flux or vapor concentrations in the subslab, those kinds of things. And again, this is likely more common for new construction, because as you can imagine, you would have more control over that highly permeable subslab material than you would if you're bringing it in as a retrofit. So again, the components for subslab venting are very similar to subslab depressurization, with some added ones here where you could be using something like an aerated floor system, which you'll also hear about later under the passive module. But here in the construction picture here, those black domes are a aerated floor system that creates those void spaces. And an additional component for subslab venting is maybe some on-purpose put-in inlets to help draw air into the subslab that you're then venting out on the other side, and that's creating that dilution air. Okay, so we're going to stop for a second and have a knowledge check, and we've got the poll open there. So if you have two different scenarios, scenario A and scenario B, which condition is more amenable to subslab venting? Is it A, where you have high permeable gravel under the slab, or is it scenario B, where you have low permeability native soil underneath your slab? Which one would be more amenable to the venting mitigation approach versus the depressurization mitigation approach? Is it scenario A or B? And we'll give you a few seconds to answer that question, and then we'll talk about the answer. Okay, great. So it looks like many people say scenario A. Let me close this so I can get to my button. Whoops. And yes, you were right. There's a very pale yellow box around that scenario A. And that's the correct answer. The gravel will be highly permeable, which will be more like a venting system than really a depressurization system. But I want to dig into that a little bit more. Maybe this example next will help sort of illustrate the point that I'm trying to make with the difference between the two systems. So if you have this fictitious building and you have a suction point in the building, if this was a highly permeable gravel, so like the picture, like the little sub picture on the top right, with gravel or void space under the building, and you start pulling air from this one suction point, perhaps you will get some depressurization, and that targeted differential pressure value you were looking for may reach out to this circle that we have here. So maybe it goes that far away from the point, you can have a measurable differential pressure that's the target one you're looking for. But since this is really well vented subslab area, what if you did a tracer test and maybe put some helium a little bit further away from the suction point and saw see if you could see it at your suction point, you could probably see that your suction point really has an influence on the airflow that is somewhere in this green circle, which is a lot bigger of an influence than if you just look at differential pressure. And then maybe you want to do some more complicated or in-depth modeling with some leaky model like Hantush-Jacob model or something like that. You may be able to see that you have a measurable velocity of air somewhere in this big maroon circle. And maybe it's modeling, but you know, the point is here that with a sub-sub venting system, you're likely going to see a lot of influence that you may not be able to measure with just a targeted differential pressure. So if you're really thinking that your system is going to have a lot more of a venting component to it, you may want to think about possibly some other performance measurements to do so that people understand why your system is working. So the third out of the four tech sheets that we put together was on this next approach, which is sub-membrane depressurization. And this, again, is very similar to sub-slab depressurization. But as you can tell from the name, instead of you depressurizing the space under a slab, you're depressurizing the space under a membrane that you're putting down as part of your mitigation approach construction. So this is something that would be preferred in a space like a crawl space, because putting that membrane down and then depressurizing underneath it will prevent the vapors from getting into the building in the first place. And that's the key difference to the next tech sheet I'll go through after this one. So again, they're often in places where there are dirt floors or crawl spaces. We've also put them in buildings where the concrete floor is so degraded that we would have to put a new concrete floor in order to make it a competent barrier for sub-slab depressurization. So maybe instead we put in a membrane because maybe it's not a very well trafficked basement or crawl space, and we can use a membrane to create that seal. So as you can imagine, this is probably something that is more for residential spaces where you're going to find crawl spaces. Although I'm here in New England, we have lots of scary old manufacturing buildings along rivers that will have crawl spaces that could use depressurization versus a regular basement. So they do exist in industrial and commercial settings for sure. The fan is also typically, again, always outside the occupiable living space, and or you bring it outside. In this picture, it's showing in the occupied living space. So the components, again, are going to be similar to a sub-sub depressurization system, and its additional components are the membrane itself, which is sealed to the sides of the crawl space. In this case, you can see in the picture, there's some batting there, sealing that white membrane to the edges of the crawl space. And then you have to have some sort of vapor collection plenum or some piping under that membrane to draw the air out and through your fan and out into the atmosphere. And then the other equipment is the same, some sort of measurement equipment or condensate bypass or emission controls, if that's something that you need in your particular state. All right, so the last tech sheet is the one that is sort of probably one of your last ditch efforts. This is the one that you'd come to and only if all the other ones would not be feasible for your project. And this is crawl space ventilation. And the reason it's sort of last is because in this case, the vapors are still getting into the space, but then we're using venting, basically dilution, to mitigate the potential for vapor intrusion. So that's why it's sort of the last, because it will require a little bit more energy because you're constantly trying to turn over the air inside of these crawl spaces. You could have some significant heating or cooling losses depending on where you are and what time of the year it is. For both that space that you're in and the living space or working space above it. So that's why it's one of the ones we kind of want to turn to at the end. Again, it's often something that you would turn to for a residential building because they're the ones that would have crawl spaces that you potentially can't enter because they're too small or they have features that don't allow you to do something like membrane depressurization. So again, there might be some heating and cooling losses, like I mentioned, but there also might be some heating loss in the crawl space itself. So if this is the type of building where all your water pipes go down from the first floor and through your crawl space, you might need to be worried about pipe freezing if you're in some of the colder climates. So that's something that has to be worked into your active mitigation design. I think we talk about that on the next slide here. So the components that will be additional for a crawl space ventilation system potentially could be something like temperature actuated heating. So you might need some sensors in that crawl space to make sure if it's going to get too cold, you end up, there's some sort of heater that you have attached that can blow warmer air into that crawl space to make sure that pipes don't freeze. And that picture on the right, something similar was happening there. The pipe went into the crawl space. We sort of closed off the access point from the current, the basin part of the building to the crawl space part of the building. And then there would need to be some sort of temperature control in there because now we've isolated it from the regular part of the basement and freezing pipes could happen. So those are the endpoints of where we want to end up in our active mitigation approaches, but how do we get there? So if we assume that you already know because you went through your VI CSM conceptual site model during our previous session and you know the type of active mitigation that you want to put into this building, you want to implement, how do you get through the design process? So what ITRC created is what we started calling our process fact sheet. So to get back to this document map that Kelly showed, the active mitigation fact sheet and all those tech sheets I was just mentioning are these orange boxes sort of in the middle of the document map. And then we have these three process fact sheets that get us through the various different stages of VI mitigation approaches. And they're across all of the approaches, not just active. They talk about passive and remediation and rapid response, but each of them has to go through some sort of design, some sort of post-installation verification, and some sort of ongoing OM&M. So the design considerations fact sheet, which we'll talk about right now, has components of other mitigation approaches, but the part of it that we're going to talk about right now are the design considerations that have to do with active mitigation. So this is a little bit of a picture of what the but this process fact sheet looks like, the design considerations fact sheet. And what we did in the fact sheet is we went through lots of design considerations. And then we talked a little bit about how a particular design consideration is either more or less important to, from in my case, active mitigation. So these are written for all types of mitigation approaches. And as an example, I want to go through just a couple of the design considerations that have to do with active in the next few slides. But I also don't want you to forget, as it says on the slide here, that your design, the process of you going through your design, is going to take into account your conceptual site model, which you already have looked at because you've landed on this design page. Your design is also going to have to consider how folks at the end are going to be able to verify that your system is working and still working. And then you also want your design to be able to have components in it for you to be able to tell when you might be able to turn it off in the end. So you're looking during your design, you are still looking forwards and backwards to make sure that your design meets everything you know so far and then things that how it's going to run up until the future. So the couple of design considerations that I pulled out for to show you here are just a few. There's lots more in that process fact sheet. But the first one that's important for active mitigation design is building type. I mean, this is the sort of first place where you stop. And there's different design considerations if you're looking at new construction, which we talked about before, which are, you're going to have different things to think about. You're going to be thinking about maybe combining your active mitigation with some passive, like a barrier. You're going to be thinking about how can I put this system in and maybe just stub it up to no fan and then maybe add a fan later. And those, how you're going to lay out your pipes, you have control over where the pipes go potentially with new construction. So those are going to be some of the design considerations. They're going to very much affect your design, whether the building is new. If the building is existing, that also is going to affect your design, but in a very different way, right? So some of them will be the foundation type. A lot of times we're running into industrial buildings that have been added onto, you know, every 20 years for the past 100 years. So you have lots of different multiple foundations, and that's going to affect your design. Is the slab, does the slab have good integrity? Is it full of cracks that need to be sealed, like in this picture, sort of in the center where the suction point was against the wall? And then you can see faintly some sealed crack, floor cracks there that needed to be sealed for the system to be effective. We're going to need to know the preferential pathways, where the floor drains are, that kind of thing. And we're going to understand how the HVAC system operates, because we are going to need to overcome that HVAC system in order to have the something like a sub-slab depressurization system work. Other ones that are listed here, and there's more in the fact sheet, are even things like, where can we put piping on the exterior of the building that is going to be okay with the tenant or the property owner, or other stakeholders may have some opinions about where piping can go, where blowers can go, where blowers can safely go, that kind of thing. So those are all considerations that are to directly affect your design. On top of that, there's also soil permeability, depth of water. Those are also going to affect your design. And going into soil permeability, one of the more important and probably unique to active mitigation in existing buildings is information you get for your design from something that we're calling here subslab diagnostics. So different people call this different things. Pressure field extension testing, listed on the slide, is one. Communication testing is another. If you're more of a SVE system engineer, you might call this ROI, raise of influence testing. They're all essentially mean the same thing, which is that we're drawing suction on one test point, and we're measuring further away from that test point where we can still see differential pressure. So this is specifically for subslab depressurization systems. You can see in that picture on the screen, our suction point or our test point is this point with the white PVC tubing coming out of it. And you would then look for differential pressure maybe at 10 feet away from that point, 20 feet away from that point, 30, 40, 50 feet away from that point, to understand the number of suction points you might need, where they need to go, and the size of the fan or fans that you might be putting on this building. And this is not a have to do for active mitigation or for subslab depressurization in an existing building. It kind of depends on the complexity of the building, the complexity of your project. If you're doing a design build, maybe you're doing this as you go. If it's a very large building, you may want to do this in more than one place. If it's a small residential home, maybe you don't do it at all. So it's none of these things are have to have. That's why they're considerations, but something that you as a project team or you as a regulator want to see if they did it or if they didn't do it, why they didn't do it, to get more information about the project. And the last consideration I want to go through is another important one. And it's not almost not a really a consideration, but it's the design documentation. So the design work plan, these are the important parts that need to go into your design. The design work plan is going to have things like your design basis. Why do you think VI is occurring or could occur in the future? And then how is the mitigation approach that you chose going to control that vapor intrusion and meet the design objectives that you should also put into this design work plan? So those are the kind of information that you start with. Your design documentation is going to include permitting, what permitting you think you're going to need for your site. And that might go from none to a lot, depending on what city or state or county that you're working in. And it changes from place to place. So what you need to get for permits, if you need to get permits, what your layout is going to look like, your drawings, your different detailed drawings for the different components, all your specifications. And then listed here too is really important, is how you're going to check on construction quality, put that in your plan ahead of time also, and also put in your plan ahead of time in this design plan, how you're going to verify your system. What is that initial, at least your initial idea of what operations, maintenance, and monitoring is going to be? Likely afterwards, you will have to redo that OM&M plan or add to it, but there should be an idea of how the system is going to be monitored during your design. And then ideally, you have some sort of plan in there too. That's your initial plan on how you're going to know when you'll be able to have to shut the system down or temporarily shut the system down to check whether the system is needed or not anymore. So a companion document to the design process fact sheet is the checklist, is the system design and documentation checklist, which is very similar to the process fact sheet, except it's more in a tabulated format, more of, you can see these yes, no, or not applicable questions. So they're really prompts. I think Kelly said at the beginning that you can download these and you can change them as you need to. There's a lot of information in the checklists, and it's for, again, both active and passive. So it's all in one checklist. So some of these items just by definition might not be applicable to your site, but it does give you some prompts and some reminders. Oh, did I look for this? And if I didn't, is there a reason why I didn't, or do I need to go back and look for information on this particular design consideration? So the checklist is there for you to use pieces of or all of, depending on the complexity of your site or how applicable it is to your project. But we tried to make it comprehensive, so there was lots of information there for you to use if you needed it. Okay, so a summary of everything we went through just now. Like I said at the beginning, we had a very specific definition of active mitigation that we were using to be able to pull our documents together. We talked about many of the most common active mitigation approaches, and there's definitely other ones out there, and they're touched upon in the active mitigation fact sheet, and there are references to get some additional information about those. We talked about a very few of the design considerations. There's lots of things to consider, but we highlighted some of the more important ones to give you an idea of how the design process fact sheet is written and what those key elements are that would go into design work plan and design documentation. So in the chronology of events, after you have your system, after you've chose your system and you've designed your system, now the next steps would be to install your system, turn it on, verify that it's working as you expected it to under your design objectives, and then to keep it running using routine OM&M. And hopefully in the future, somewhere down this long road, you will be able to plan to exit this project, maybe shut the system down or turn the system over to the owners or something like that if they wanted to use it for other purposes. So these subsequent steps are going to be covered in a little bit for the other process fact sheets later in this session. So with that, I'm going to take a quick break, I think, Devin, and we're going to take some questions or move over to passive is next.
Yeah, thank you so much, Catherine. So at this time, we will open our first question and answer portion of the training. We don't have any questions yet in the Q&A pod here, so I will just say that if any of our attendees here have any additional training topics that they are interested in, ITRC has a lot of archive trainings available on Clue, and we encourage you to check those out. And we definitely, again, want to hear back from you at the end of the training course today through the feedback form, and that is how you would obtain a certificate of completion. So with that, I'm gonna just pause here for a moment or two and see if we get any questions in the Q&A pod. We will have two other Q&As during the training here today, so you will have two other opportunities to ask questions as well. So our trainers, we do have a question here. Any thoughts about using remote sensing tools?
Oh, yes. You can use, there's a couple of them that are out there from some of the more basic ones that you, like, you know, the old school auto dialers where you can tell if a system is on or off. But there's also remote sensing tools that will allow you to moderate blower speed so that if you have a system installed and it's the building sort of operational changes allow you to have different settings on your fan. So in the wintertime, if you really have to overcome a lot of building HVAC, your system can ramp up and meet your design objectives, mostly differential pressure under the floor. And if it's the summertime and your HVAC systems are all off and you can meet those design objectives with a fan running at a lower speed, then the system will ramp down. So remote, if that's what you mean by remote sensing, which I think it is, that's definitely out there in a way that you can run a system more cost effectively, because you'll use only the amount of power that you need to keep a system right at your design objectives versus having the blower run at the worst case speed all the time in order to meet only the times when worst case is needed. So yeah, that's out there. Some companies are doing it, but you can also do sort of a lower tech version of that, which would be, you know, one of those simple systems where you have like an auto dialer that basically calls your cell phone when the power goes out or the vacuum turns off, that kind of thing.
Perfect. Thank you, Catherine. Sorry, trying to find my mute button there. Do you have any thoughts on warning systems for poor indoor air quality?
Oh. I have had homeowners reach out before in places where we have some residential VI, you know, SSD systems in someone's house, and they will have gone on Amazon and they will have bought a, you know, something off of the website that was an air quality home meter and ask, hey, this is looking like it's higher. Is that because of your system? I mean, my opinion is that it's really hard for anyone to just go out and buy a meter that's going to give you something like a chlorinated solvent understanding of what's inside your building. So if you're looking for trichloroethene, for example, you're not going to be able to find a home meter that's going to give you that measurement in real time. So I think that those easy to read meters for something like chlorinated solvents are not going to be effective. But I do know that people are searching for that sort of easy to understand and quick to read meter. And the research is out there and they're working on it. So it's possible that we'll have something that would never be able to read something as accurate as sending a sample to the lab, but maybe would be able to give you some sort of relative understanding of what's in your air over time. But I'm not sure we're quite there yet.
All right, thank you, Catherine. Next question. How would you deal with petroleum contaminated groundwater coming up into sumps, causing a vapor impact to the basement and first floor apartments? Currently, there are ventilation fans running to remove the vapors.
Okay, so groundwater coming into the building and it's in the sump, and then it's volatilizing just straight into the air. It sounds like, is that what you said, Devin?
Yeah. So, contaminated groundwater coming into the sumps, causing vapor impact in a basement in the first floor apartment.
Excuse me. So it's always a fine line between dealing with vapor intrusion and then dealing with essentially water intrusion and then the water volatilizing. It kind of takes you outside of the vapor intrusion aspect of it, because it's not vapors coming through the ground, it's the water that's in the building off-gassing. And there's ways to seal sumps so that the sump still works, it can accept water, but vapors can't off-gas from the water that's inside the sump by sealing it. And then, so that's would be my first reaction, that. And we've also put in things like French drains around the edges of a basement that also are sealed, so that water can get in there, but the vapors can't get back out again. But yeah, you've got a water intrusion issue first, and then the vapor off volatilizing issue is sort of second. So I know that Matt Williams is on one of the panelists here, might be able to talk again at the end of the session, because I know shallow groundwater in Michigan is one of your biggest, one of the things that you guys really focus in on, because it tends to be an issue there with less than 5 feet of groundwater, right?
You nailed it there, Catherine. There's a lot of things that you have to handle too with when you have that groundwater intrusion issue, and there are ways to address the contaminated groundwater when it's entered into the building, but that's kind of a different path than what we wanted to talk about here too. Because it is typically limited to only a few states that have a lot of shallow groundwater, and they also need to have basements. that people live in. So, I mean, you have to have both of those conditions, and those tend to be, in Michigan tends to be one of them that has a lot of those sites that happen like that. But if it does happen, Catherine hit it on the spot, you got to deal with the groundwater somehow, and then you got to deal with the off-gassing off of whatever came into the building too. So.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks, Catherine and Matt. Next question, how can we confirm that a building's air is clean or free of contaminants? Do you have any recommendations or experience with any best case or best practices?
So I think they mean after we've installed the system and turned it on, how do we confirm? And one of the modules we'll talk about right after passive is the post-installation verification process. So I might table that question till after Keith's talk in a little bit. But so put it on the side and we'll address it after his talk.
All right, sounds good. So with that, we are going to move to the next section, the advanced screen here, passive mitigation. And I believe Matt Williams will be getting us oriented first. So with that, I'd like to welcome Matt Williams from the Michigan Department of Environmental Great Lakes and Energy. And then following him will be Rick Gillespie with Regenesis.
Thank you, Devin. And we'll get things started here. So I'm going to kick it off, just like Catherine did, with kind of giving you a little bit of an objective of the module today. And we're going to talk about passive mitigation, the definition, and how we consider passive mitigation. We're going to give you some technology overviews, and I'm going to go through some of the primary ones that we've seen out there as we've gone through it. And then Rick's going to come in and talk about the design considerations, the installation planning, and the construction quality assurance when we're dealing with these passive mitigation strategies. So let's start out with what is passive mitigation. And opposite of what Catherine said, passive mitigation does not rely on mechanical means or power means to move the vapors. It uses a technology that either blocks or diverts contaminant vapors from entering the building or diffuses them. And it relies on natural mechanisms to make them work. So it relies on pressure gradients, flow, things like that, that will make the air or indoor air safe. As compared to active systems, what Catherine just talked about, where you're required a fan to run to get to certain performance mechanisms. The passive mitigation fact sheet is on the website. The link to it's on the bottom of this page. It gives you a summary to the guide of the content and as well as other work products that are out there. It provides you lots of different links to additional information, as well as key definitions to terms that we use as we go through it. And it also provides references to previous ITRC documents and other state vapor intrusion guidance documents where you can see and how it links all together. So I'm going to start things out talking about three common passive barrier systems. And those are asphalt latex membranes, or ALMs, thermoplastic membranes, or TMs, and composite membranes, or CMs. These are the three most common barriers that we see that tend to be approved by various regulatory agencies. We're going to kind of deep dive a little bit into each of these. And if you need more information, like we talked about, feel free to check out the ITRC document for even more information. But we'll start things out with asphalt latex membranes, or ALMs. And basically, they are a barrier to prevent VI into new buildings, like we talked about. They typically comprise of a base layer, which has some kind of, sometimes it's an impermeable, sometimes it's gravel, you can see. It also deals with a continuous spray applied asphalt layer and a cap sheet. So they're effective for a wide range of contaminants. And they are applied across the nation. ALMs, they apply typically to a thermoplastic membrane, and the manufacturers will provide specific installation instructions on how to apply them and what kind of QAQC as well as installation things you need to go through. Thermoplastic membranes, when you look at the picture, they look very similar to what we just talked about with ALMs. The difference is they have a single layer sheet system with typically heat welded seams as compared to using an asphaltic compound to seal them. TMs are different. They're typically thicker than what moisture vapor barriers are. And so a lot of building codes require vapor barriers. These are different. They are significantly different. They don't bend as easy. They don't move. But they are also, they can be effective for a wide range of contaminants as well. In the picture, you can kind of see how thick they are, right? And you can see that they're kind of rigid and they'll stay out there. But they require a heat welded seam for them to combine. Their terminations require some kind of mechanical fastening to either the walls or the pipes. And you can kind of see in that picture again how they're sealing the boots to the pipes that go below grade. A lot of times the manufacturers will have prefabricated boots to help seal those penetrations where they go through. And manufacturers will also provide some detailed installation instructions about what you got to be aware of, what kind of safety factors you need to take care of while they're being installed, puncture resistance, things like that. The final membrane to talk about is composite membranes. And those are, they comprise of multiple materials such as EVOH, metallicized films and spray on emulsions, even ALMs. And what they do is they are effective for a wide range of contaminants because they use a combination of different materials to put it together in that membrane. And so all three pictures, you kind of look at the general 50,000 foot view and they look different or they look very similar. The reality is a lot of the materials that go into it are very different in how they function and work. And that's probably the key thing. Composite membranes, just like we talked about before, they have seams and penetrations that are sealed by various methods. A lot of times they use some kind of spray a coating that will seal or overlap. And the manufacturers will provide detailed and specific installation instructions about where they can be placed, how you seal off the terminations, things like that. There are other types of passive systems that the ITRC document talks about, including aerated floors. And you heard Catherine talk about that a little bit. Passive subside venting, and we'll talk, and she also talked about that as well. We'll talk about how it's a little different when we talk about it being passive. Epoxy floor coatings, as well as building design. So aerated floors, and you can kind of see these are very similar to what Catherine talked about when we were talking about aerated floors. This is kind of one of those technologies that kind of goes back and forth between subslab venting and subslab depressurization, or even just passively working. And that's because they create a open void in some kind of form that allows a low resistance to air, which increases the air exchange rate and kind of works through diffusion and actually causing the concentrations to decrease over time. The most common ones you can see there is Cuplex. It's a proprietary form that they could put in. It's typically used a lot of times in new builds. We have seen it retrofitted in some buildings, especially if you have shallow groundwater that's intruding. This is probably one of the types of forms that they can put in because you can actually address groundwater intrusion as well as things that are coming off of the vapors as well. Another type that we talk about when we talk about passive mitigation is passive subslab venting. Catherine talked about subslab venting using fans. It is fundamentally different than subslab depressurization in that it relies on pressure differences to induce flow. Now, more often than not, because you have to design the permeable aggregate around the pipe, it's more applicable to new construction. It's also typically used when the concentrations are not that high or not expected to cause that large of an increase in indoor air concentrations. So a lot of times subside venting systems are used or relied upon where there is maybe a potential for vapor intrusion to occur. And if it does occur, that there are lower level concentrations. So that's typically where we see the subside venting systems. The other one, passive subside venting, very similar. Again, a lot of these work pretty close. They look a little bit different. Terminology is a little bit different. A lot of it has to do with the way that it's designed, the way the permeable aggregate causes the airflow through it, and things like that. You can see in this picture the collection network, as we call it out as well. the collection plenum in this design has one that comes to a common area before it goes up to the roof. And so it kind of breaks it down and shows you kind of a different view of what a subside venting system looks like as it's being installed. Epoxy floor coatings works a lot like the barriers that we talked about, but instead of being below the concrete, they tend to be on top of the concrete for the most part. They're applicable to a wide range of building types. They use, again, like a passive barrier on top of it. What it does is it seals the cracks and prevents vapors from migrating through it. Often, these epoxy floor coatings also still require some kind of venting system that is installed in part of it. Part of the benefit of these systems is they can help protect concrete and they can repair as well. They may need the concrete repaired before you put it on, but it also provides kind of a protective coating in industrial applications. The people that put it down are specialty applicators that are familiar, and they usually have thickness requirements that go in, but they are available for a wide range of contaminants as well. And finally, building design for passive vapor mitigation systems. You know, we talk about high rises and things like that. A lot of times where we can make parking garages beneath, we may be able to design different buildings so that mitigation systems are not necessary. Maybe they're only required for certain parts of the building, like possibly where an elevator intercepts. So there's a lot of times that buildings can be designed where you have large naturally vented or mechanically vented, if it's a parking garage beneath it, that may look very different than a different type of mitigation system. Often you got to look at the ventilation rate required to mitigate the VI. And obviously if it's an open parking garage, you have Mother Nature doing a lot of that ventilation for you. In some of the warmer areas, you can see where there's raised foundations and things like that. Like if you get way down south, Louisiana has a lot of these where they have raised homes. These types of homes typically don't work so well up north because of the freezing and things like that. But that's not to say that we don't have some. When you look at some mobile homes and things like that, they basically are these types of buildings that are on raised foundations that have a lot of air exchange rate through it. But basically what you get through it is some naturally induced air exchange rate, and the ventilation rate is typically higher and acceptable to mitigate any potential VI risks. So I wanted to do a quick knowledge check as we go through this. So what mitigation technology is commonly used in combination with a passive barrier system? So we'll do the survey here for a minute. You got A, aerated floors, B, epoxy floor coatings, C is passive subside venting systems, or D, none of the above. So we'll give you a second to answer the question. And so let's take a look at the results quick and see how well we're doing. So passive subside venting systems, that's the overall one that we see here, and that is what the group agreed with as well. So when we look at the which one's common in common combination with the passive is passive subside venting systems. Now you do see other types of technologies applied with passive barriers, but typically, like if you had a passive barrier, you wouldn't do an epoxy floor coating as well. You wouldn't have an aerated floor beneath it. So again, the most likely answer that you would put on this is passive subside venting systems. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rick, where he's going to take you into more of the details of a documentation and installation.
Great. Thanks, Matt, for the overview of the various passive barrier approaches. Just a quick introduction. My name is Rick Gillespie, and in my role, I work with a wide variety of stakeholders, including regulators, environmental consultants, general contractors, property owners, and installation contractors. I mention that because everyone that I just mentioned has some level of ownership in the design and installation of passive mitigation systems. My goal in the next few slides, is really to bring a focus to the design process and to highlight the things that we should all be looking for to ensure a successful installation. Now, one quick disclaimer, the remainder of the presentation assumes that you've already selected a passive mitigation approach for either a new or existing building. So with that as a quick primer, let's get started down the design path. Give just a minute for these slides to advance. Perfect. Went one too many. Great. All right. So let me just set your expectations of what we're going to cover in the next 10 slides. Unfortunately, it's just not possible to cover every detail that you would need to learn to become an expert in passive mitigation design. But here's the good news. ITRC has created a series of fact sheets and resources to help you become an expert or at least very experienced. One of the things I love about these fact sheets is you can jump in, insert into topic areas that are of most interest to you. So for this presentation, we're going to narrow the focus to the design considerations sections. If you notice at the bottom of the slide, everything that we cover today can be found in greater depth and detail in that fact sheet. So my hope is you'll use this presentation as an overview of the topic, but I always recommend that you really spend time in the individual fact sheets. It will help you understand the design elements and everything that goes into a successful passive mitigation system. All right, so if you think about what is the backbone of a successful installation, it really gets down to design considerations. And step one, and probably the most critical step, is having a thorough understanding of the vapor intrusion conceptual site model. That's often referred to as the CSM. Now, the CSM is important because it has a direct impact on the design process for passive mitigation. You'll often hear the term design basis, and it's important for you to remember. The design basis really provides an explanation of how the selected approach will meet the remedy objectives for the site. So before you proceed with the design, you really have to have a firm understanding of the vapor source and the contaminants concerns. You have to know, are the CRCs present, whether they pose an unacceptable risk to the people in the building. You need to have a good understanding of the site geology and hydrogeology, things like soil type, soil moisture, depth of groundwater. These are all important design factors that should be defined in the CSM. Question we'll address at the end of this presentation, is this a new building or is it an existing building? What's the future use of the building? Those are all good questions as you get into the design phase. And so as in the previous slide, we discussed the importance of the design basis. This slide provides an overview of the components that a passive mitigation design would commonly include. Really, you need to think of this as the recipe. And with any good recipe, it should be so clear that anyone could review it and have an understanding of the different components, the types of materials to be installed, the layout of the various system components. For example, a passive mitigation system must cover the entire area of the potential entry for VOCs. The details should include instructions on how penetrations and terminations at perimeter walls will be configured within the system. If your site incorporates passive venting, the drawing should include documentation of proper vent layout and vent stack placement. We always recommend that the design specification include installation and instructions and quality assurance testing specifications. And then finally, the design drawing should include standards for performance testing and how you're going to evaluate the effectiveness of the passive mitigation approach. So after the vapor mitigation design is complete and the project is set for installation, it is a best practice to conduct a pre-construction meeting. These are often referred to as the pre-con meeting. Now, the purpose of the pre-con meeting should be to communicate to all contractors on the importance of the passive mitigation system. Vapor mitigation, the risks involved, may not be fully understood by all the contractors. The pre-con meeting provides you an opportunity to clearly define the passive mitigation approach. Well, who do we recommend or who should attend the pre-con meeting? Well, anyone who's going to be involved with the installation of the mitigation system. Most pre-con meetings are run by the general contractor, the design engineer would be present, the environmental consultant, the mitigation system installation contractor, and often the passive mitigation system manufacturer would be present at that pre-con meeting. It was mentioned earlier, I'll mention it again. I would also include other trades who may be on site during or immediately following the installation process. This would include the concrete contractor, electricians, and plumbers who will perform work around the passive mitigation system. So imagine we're in the construction trailer, we're on site, we're at the pre-con meeting. What is important for us to cover? Well, all parties should review the vapor mitigation design drawings. They want to do that to confirm the details. This allows all contractors to review and confirm aspects of the system design. Things like substrate specifications, the vent layout, the location of vent risers and utility penetrations. It also allows the general contractor to clarify the construction and installation sequence with all the trades. So on our next slide, we're going to get into system verification. And as we transition, I would encourage you to review the type, frequency, and duration of the installation oversight at the pre-con meeting. This ensures that everyone's on the same page, and it will significantly increase the likelihood that the system has been installed in accordance with the system design. All right, so imagine you've done everything right to this point. Your site investigation, your CSM are perfect. Your passive mitigation design is beautiful. The next step is critical. It seems obvious, but don't assume that the installation will go right if you don't inspect the work that is being performed. You want to ensure that the mitigation design has requirements for construction quality control. This would include observation and inspection of the system as it's being installed. In simple terms, system verification makes sure that all the hard work up to this point is done properly. Now, the type of system verification will vary by technology approach, but common approaches include smoke testing, which is shown on the right. Smoke testing allows airflow to be done after the passive barrier is installed. Often, QA will include coupon sampling to ensure that you're maintaining minimum mill thicknesses. You'll also have oversight documentation on the amount of materials that were applied per square foot. So I mentioned on the right, and it may be hard to see on your screen, if you look closely, you'll see smoke coming up through the passive barrier. So the installation contractor has a QA/QC process is injecting non-toxic smoke to identify any leaks in the barrier. And that may sound bad, but in reality, this gives you that QA/QC check to know that we need to go back and repair those areas where leaks would occur. Typically, leaks occur at pipe penetrations, and installers are looking for that to ensure that they're competently sealed. All right, so you know, what's the most important building factor affecting passive mitigation system design? A hint is on the screen. It really is the type of building construction, either new construction or existing buildings. The type of construction, whether new or existing, really defines the options available for the passive mitigation design. New buildings provide a higher level of control and offer a greater number of options for the approaches to address potential VI issues. Existing buildings have fewer options for passive mitigation. You have to work around the existing building conditions. In short, they're more difficult to address, but not impossible. The next two slides will dig into greater detail on these two types of buildings, new versus existing. But before we go into the next slide, some situations may require rapid mitigation of vapor intrusion. If you are in an urgent scenario on an existing building, I would direct you to the ITRC Rapid Response and Ventilation Fact Sheet for more information. We talked about new construction being simpler or easier for passive mitigation. It's because it allows for a high degree of control over the variables that affect system performance. In your design, it should specify the installation procedures. This reduces the potential for damage to the installed system. Some examples of that would be, hey, let's do the concrete pour as soon as possible after the system installation. Can we prohibit or limit vehicle traffic on the passive barrier? We're going to specify that sharp objects be kept off the installed system. New construction allows designers to coordinate with architects to ensure that riser pipes and stack locations are consistent with building use, aesthetics, and applicable building codes. New construction also allows for combination of passive mitigation approaches. For example, passive barriers are often combined with passive venting. This approach creates redundancy. It allows for greater flexibility in the event that the system needs to be converted from passive to active. But what about existing buildings? Well, existing buildings don't provide the flexibility that comes with new construction. When designing a passive mitigation approach for existing buildings, it's important to understand the condition of the existing foundation. We're going to look at the foundation type, the slab condition, preferential pathways, and the potential for utility penetrations, how the HVAC system is run, height of the building. Is this a historic building? Are there building codes that need to be addressed? Existing buildings may need to be modified, and the implementation of these systems requires a high level of planning and construction oversight. The photo on the right shows a passive barrier being installed over an existing slab, where a cap slab will be installed to serve as the new finished floor. As a wrap up on design considerations, I want to stress the importance of stakeholder engagement. Owners, tenants, architects, especially architects, often have strong opinions about the aesthetic effects and potential inconvenience experienced when the installation of a passive mitigation system. One example I would give you is owners should know who to contact if their epoxy floor coating is damaged after installation. Or if post-installation the slab needs to be cut for new plumbing, owners should be aware of the steps to repair that passive mitigation system. So we're an hour and 15 in. I know everybody was excited about a knowledge check. So here it is. What is the most important element of a good design? Is it figuring it out as you go? Is it skipping the conceptual site model, the CSM? Is it letting the project team know you want passive mitigation? Or is it proper site evaluation and planning? So what's the most important element of a good design? Give folks a few minutes here. Maybe five more seconds. I'll give you a hint. The CSM serves as the design basis for the passive mitigation system. So we consider that to be one of the most important elements of a good design. All right. So 99% of you said proper site evaluation and planning. Very, very good. Devin, I think we can close that one out. And then I will advance to the next couple slides here. All right, so we're kind of back to the beginning, and I want to pause for a moment and just talk about this trailhead and point to some of the additional resources. If you look in the bottom right, you'll see a system design and documentation checklist. This is a valuable tool in the design process. It's designed to prompt users to think about each aspect of the design. Not everything in those checklists will be applicable, but it's a great place to start for reviewing the many aspects of passive BI mitigation. The complexity of your site will dictate how applicable the checklist is for you. So depending on your site conditions, the systems and design documentation checklist provides information to proceed through the pre-system installation process. It will help you to think about each aspect. And what I love about the checklist is they're flexible. Sites with complex CSMs may utilize the checklist to a greater degree than less complex sites. So in summary, our goal in today's presentation was to cover four main topic areas. First, we discussed the definition of passive mitigation, which involves blocking or diverting vapors from entering building by various methods. The common attribute that each passive technology shares is that they protect the building without the use of mechanical devices. No power is required, and no equipment that requires operations and maintenance are utilized in passive mitigation approaches. We provided an overview of the various major categories of passive mitigation. It's important to remember that each approach has advantages and limitations depending on the building type and the site conditions. The fact sheets will provide the detail you need on when and where to use each approach. We highlighted the key elements of system design, the importance of using the CSM to develop a design basis, and we emphasize the need for design documentation to ensure a successful installation. Finally, and we really want to stress the importance of a robust QA/QC process with oversight. This will help to ensure that the passive mitigation approach selected is installed per the design. So where do you go from here? Well, the learning never stops. So I would encourage you to review other important modules that will help you in your journey to be in becoming a VA mitigation expert. This includes passive mitigation system verification, conducting routine OM&M, and assessing the need for continuing operation of the passive mitigation system. And we're there. We are at the end of the passive mitigation system. We'll open it up for any Q&A.
Great. Thank you, Matt and Rick. With that, I'm going to look to the Q&A pod here for our next session of question and answers. So our first question is one that we read during the last Q&A, but we pushed out until after that passive mitigation section. So our first question is, how can we confirm that building air is clean or free of contaminants?
Now, one more.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I think Catherine, what she meant to say was like, it's the next session that'll go through and talk about the confirmation of that. So it's coming. So just hold on that, because I think.
All right. We will tuck that back in. We will tuck that back in and bring that up during that third and final QA.
Right.
All right. Thank you, Matt. All right. So next question, the first one, for new mixed use construction with a subterranean garage and a low risk of vapor intrusion due to BTEX, would you recommend some preventative mitigation measures for the first floor, such as epoxy barrier?
So when we've gotten these sites in, right, I think the first key is when you look at the PVI guidance document is the separation distances where it would likely occur. I will tell you from the state, I know people like the presumptive approach, but I think we mitigate too much some of the times. And I think that we need data. You need to make data-driven decisions. And a lot of times for that subterranean garage, the only spots that we really need to look at is where there are portions that connect directly to the living space. Like off, there might be offices in the subterranean garage. There might be stairways. There might be elevator shafts. Those would be where we would kind of look at, and most of the time look at the presumptive remedies, especially if it was a low risk BTEX release or low concentrations. That's kind of what's going through my head, is that it's not super high concentrations, that it's most parking garages are a couple ramps beneath the building. I think we need to focus more on the stairways, the elevator shafts. Passive barrier technologies is a great strategy for those too. And especially if you're doing pre-builds, you can use a lot of different liner companies, products as well, to design things even before you get to the inside of the shafts or of the floor as well, right? Sound about right?
Yeah, Matt, I would just build on that. As usually if you're doing new construction, there are lower cost options than epoxy floor coatings. So making the assumption that you had a low risk BTEX site where you wanted to ensure protection and it was new construction, I would look at passive approaches beneath the slab as just being a lower cost option. And with that subterranean garage, you may not even have a risk profile for it. So EFCs could work, but generally not utilized on new construction, typically used on existing buildings.
I think the other thing, to kind of echo what Rick has said, but from a different too, is a lot of elevator shafts require a sump at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And if you do the EFCs, you're really not stopping that sump, especially if it's got a direct conduit or a direct pathway to the subsurface soils. Where if you look at the liner systems, you can typically design them before the elevator shaft's built so that the liner system provides that barrier before the sump. And a lot of times it's more cost effective than trying to deal with the contaminated groundwater in the sump.
All right. Thank you, Matt and Rick. Next question. Which agency regulates the permits for the design of vapor intrusion mitigation systems?
Well, I think that that varies by state regulatory agency
across nationwide, right? Some states are self-implementing programs where you can self-implement, and some states you have to go step-by-step through the different state agencies. Some as well also have different requirements when we talk either active or passive that you actually have to get building permits and things for that as well. There is a lot of different components and pieces that you have to walk through. Discharge permits possibly, as well as electrical permits. So you're going to need to talk to your regulatory agency and see where all those come to play, because every state's going to be different.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, there are states that provide guidance that people will follow, but it's going to be very dependent on the state you're building in.
All right. Thank you, Matt and Rick. Next question. What are the main hazards involved with SSDS installation in an existing building other than pouring through the roof for venting and working around building occupants?
Hey guys, I jump back in if that's a question for me.
Catherine.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably a subjective answer, but my biggest issue with existing buildings and sub depressurization systems is in some buildings, you can never really know what is in the subsurface that's going to impede your flow. So we've, without doing a lot of pre-design investigation, like those sub diagnostic tests that I talked about, oftentimes we'll do one or two and then extrapolate to other areas. And that just may not be enough. You may end up either because the soil changes or because the slab is a little bit different and you couldn't tell, or because there's a drain line that someone filled in years ago, so you don't even see it on the surface of the floor, but is creating sort of a barrier for your vacuum propagation. Those are the hazards in terms of it might not operate the way you think it is the first time you do it.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to it is like the main hazards involved with the installation. This is radon contractors do this on a regular basis for the most part, for the major components of it. You know, and as long as you have reputable firms that are doing it, that there isn't a lot of installation hazards that run into it, you know, unless you ran into something unknown. It could be, you know, like it could be a tension floor that someone wasn't aware, a post-tension floor.
Mm-hmm.
That could be something that could be a hazard if you didn't hire someone and they didn't understand what that meant. Someone drilling through a subsurface gas line that they didn't understand where it was in the building. That could be, but a lot of those times the firms that you're looking at typically has the resources and the knowledge to work through those processes. And they put people in the field to kind of look for yeah. those things or indicators of those things.
Yeah, and we're talking health and safety type hazards. You're talking about people working at height, trying to put pipes in the ceiling all along your building. I mean, there's those kind of hazards. And there's one more. A lot of times they like to put the blowers on the roof, and roofs are not always like they don't have the load bearing capacity potentially for whatever this blower is that you're putting up there. And also maybe are not built to be accessed on some sort of routine basis if needed later. So oftentimes we have to stop and think about whether or we should put it on the roof, not only for the safety of putting it on there in the first place and the integrity of the roof, but also repeat access to that fan or blower.
And I was just gonna pipe in real quick and just elaborate. Yeah, Matt mentioned the post-tension rebar issue, and that is a very serious one. And it also goes for if you're installing sub-slab points or anything like that during assessment. And if you're not aware, make sure you look it up. It's about you've got tension cables underneath the slab, and you do not want to nick those with a drill or anything like that. There's a lot of safety issues and, of course, money issues too, liability as well for building safety. So definitely.
The other one I ran into was heated flooring, right? Where there's the tubes that go through the concrete and someone cored through one of those. So they had kind of a play area for sprinklers for a while. But, you know, I think if you got people that understand what they're doing and you understand what to look for and you do the building surveys, a lot of that information is going to come out.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So looks like that's all we have for questions right now for this Q&A. We do have one more at the end. So with that, we will, Rick, do you want to do that one right now?
There was one more question, this whether there's a drawing details library available on the ITRC website. So I think the quick answer is no, but every manufacturer would have drawing details. So it would just depend on the system that was selected.
All right, thanks, Rick. Didn't mean to leave that one out, but thought we would do that in the chat, but no worries. So with that, we'll go to the next section here with system verification with Keith Broadick from, let me just pull here. Keith?
Yes.
Take it away.
All right. Thank you. We're in the home stretch. Not much left here, but these are some really critical points that we're going to get into here. Talking about system verification, operation, maintenance, and monitoring, and exit strategy. And we foreshadowed these a little bit in our earlier presentations, and we're going to get into it here. And we look at it from in really simplistic terms, too, with these three simple questions you see on the right. Related to our vapor intrusion mitigation system, is it working? Is it still working? And is it still needed? So what we're really going to talk about here is how do we verify vapor intrusion mitigation system success? How do we look at proper system performance? How do we address system underperformance? And we'll talk a bit more, again, we keep talking about communication, but the significance of early communication and planning upfront for discontinuing a mitigation system. We'll also talk about how to use the ITRC documents in your work. Like I said, communication, we're gonna keep talking about it. We talked about it early, we keep mentioning it. It is just key and it's critical. It's been repeated throughout this presentation today. What we want to do with communication is we want to keep all the stakeholders informed. And those stakeholders include your regulators, your consultants, property owners, tenants, responsible parties. You know, we just talked about what happens if you don't understand the flooring system and you drill through a heated floor. Part of that is this communication piece, talking to the owners, asking them about utilities, but being really clear, we're going to drill through your slab if we are. What will we hit under there? Will it cause problems? We want to have those conversations very early on. And as we're talking to folks, we're talking about what's going to happen. We also want to talk to them about selecting appropriate performance metrics, really to establish what's a correctly operating system? What are the baseline readings that we should have for subsequent operations, maintenance, and monitoring inspections? And we want to talk about and really confirm and drill down what are acceptable scenarios for shutdown. Sometimes those could be, are your groundwater concentrations now below any sort of vapor intrusion screening level? It could be that the soil source has been removed, but we want to talk about that early on in the process to make sure that everybody's on board with those approaches. And here's our post-installation fact sheet that we have available. And what it does is it's providing our key considerations and testing for post-installation vapor intrusion mitigation system verification. It covers active systems, passive systems, remediation, and your rapid response technologies. And it describes those elements that really should be considered during construction. We'll talk about those here. So verification, is the vapor intrusion system, mitigation system working? Matt had mentioned earlier about doing those building surveys, and that's a really important process here. And really, before we begin with our confirmation testing or even concurrent with confirmation testing, we want to conduct a building survey. We want to inspect our vapor intrusion mitigation system. And the reason why we're doing this, especially on the building conditions, looking at it really pre-construction ideally and then post-construction, is to understand how the building conditions might affect your mitigation system. We can compare that baseline survey, that pre-construction survey, to the post-construction survey to identify what changes might have occurred, because that can really happen. For instance, do we have cracks in the foundation or a poor building foundation? Do we have unsealed utility penetrations? Or even if we're looking at our system itself, incorrect system piping. All of those can decrease the effectiveness of our vapor intrusion mitigation system. And like Catherine said, we're, in some instances, we have to overcome for an active system our HVAC system inside the building. So has that changed between when we did our design and when we're actually doing our construction and testing? That can have a large impact on how well the system operates. And then we also, in the verification process, we want to talk about commissioning, which is really a series of tests, and we're recommending multiple forms of verification to confirm that the system's operating properly and that we're meeting those mitigation objectives. And some of those mitigation objectives we talked about today, sometimes it's meeting a vacuum level criteria for an active system, which ultimately will protect indoor air quality. And I guess while I'm talking about this verification step, we're not going to cover it a lot in this module, but it's important for me to point out that we need to make sure that these systems, once they're built, are operating within the confines of issued permits, building codes, and industry standards. We've talked a little bit about industry standards, and I think Matt even mentioned some building codes, and we had a question about permits. We don't cover that extensively here because it is very jurisdictional dependent. And so, but it's really important for us to mention that we have to verify that, because one thing we know is that our vapor intrusion mitigation systems, as installed, are sometimes different than as designed. And so we want to make sure that once that system's constructed, it's meeting those building permits and those building codes. I also want to point out too that different vapor intrusion mitigation systems are going to have different verification testing and different parameters that we're evaluating. We'll talk about those in a little bit of detail and where you can find some of those guidance pieces in the ITRC documents. Some of the items we talked about earlier in the passive and active modules, we talked about differential pressure, we talked about smoke test verification, and we're going to cover it a little bit more in the post-installation checklist. And another note here on communications, although in this case, it's a written communication, documentation is absolutely critical. I like the phrase here, if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen. We need to document how these systems were installed. We need as-built drawings because, as I keep saying, the constructed system a lot of times is different than the one that was designed. And so we want to have a record of what actually was installed, not just what the design engineer thought should be installed. I also want to point out that as-built drawings a lot of times are required for permits and for closing out a permit. And we also want to write down our verification performance data. A lot of times this has to be submitted to regulatory agencies as well to prove that the system's working as it was designed. And what's nice about writing this down too on our verification performance data is that it provides that baseline for comparison as we get into the OM&M phase. So some of those example system performance metrics, we've listed some here on the slide. Not all of these are going to be used at all of the sites or even for all of the technologies. Some of these should look familiar because we've covered them a little bit earlier in the module, but just to point out a couple of items here, if we're looking at a rapid response, a lot of times we're using an indoor air or a soil gas sample results, or maybe both to make a comparison of the two. If we're looking at remediation, it might be differential pressure across the slab. And to take a minute and address one of the questions that we had, how do we confirm that a building area is clean or free of contaminants? I think, you know, that fits into this process of looking at system performance metrics and verification, but it's not necessarily the only one, or it's not necessarily appropriate or very straightforward for all of the metrics here. What we're talking about today is how do we verify that these vapor intrusion mitigation systems work? And while we can collect indoor air samples to understand the levels of contaminants in the indoor air after a system's installed, just those data alone won't tell us that the system is working or not working by itself. And part of the reason for that is that in indoor air spaces, we have other contaminants that exist. They're not caused by vapor intrusion. It could be off-gassing of cleaning products, for instance. It could be, like if this shirt is dry cleaned, then it will off-gas a little bit of those dry cleaning chemicals. And you can easily pick that up in an indoor air sample. So sometimes it is tough to tell whether, you know, building air is clean or free of contaminants because of those indoor air sources. But what we're trying to hone in on here is that these are the different items that can use to confirm that your vapor intrusion mitigation system is working. And as we talked about a couple slides ago, we're really recommending multiple steps here in our verification, use more than one approach. And if you need some additional information on these, you can see the specific technology sheets that we've produced, which will talk about performance metrics that are really specific to your system and the system that you're going to install. And again, we can't stress documentation and communication enough. This is our post-installation vapor intrusion mitigation system verification checklist. It's a field-ready checklist. It covers active and passive systems. And what we tried to do with the checklist is to really make it a template that is very applicable to a lot of different sites, while recognizing that there's definitely state-specific and even site-specific needs. So the checklist is really a baseline that everyone can use, can take it out into the field and write on it and write down and verify and document that the system's working properly, but also you're able to modify it to capture those state and specific needs. And here's the first knowledge check of this module. And the question is, when is it most important to develop verification procedures and an exit strategy? Is it during the vapor intrusion investigation, during mitigation design and planning, at the time of mitigation implementation, after construction, or never? Is it really something you don't need to do? I'll give you a hint, since the title of this is based on verification and OM&M and exit strategy, it's probably not the last answer. All right, so what does everyone think here? We've got a lot of people saying during mitigation design and planning, and a couple of the other, a lot of people picked some of the other answers as well. And let's look. So what the team said was that during mitigation design and planning is when it's most important. And I want to say to the folks that selected during the vapor intrusion investigation, I'd like that because you're thinking very far ahead, very early in the process. The only challenge with that is during the vapor intrusion investigation, we haven't quite figured out if we need a vapor intrusion mitigation system. So it's really tough for us to develop those verification procedures and an exit strategy. But once we've looked at the results of that investigation and we've decided, you know what, we do need a mitigation system, that is the most important time to start developing the procedures and the strategies, is that during the mitigation design and planning. Good work, everyone. So here is our OM&M and exit strategy fact sheet, a snapshot of it. And what this fact sheet does is it really provides a strategy to confirm ongoing acceptable vapor intrusion mitigation system performance as designed. And it presents a framework for you to use as you're considering your exit strategy development, as you're engaging your stakeholders, we're providing a framework for you to use. in this fact sheet really does advocate for early stakeholder engagement on those vapor intrusion mitigation system termination criteria and actions. What will be done to actually shut the system down? And again, I'm going to caution, there may be additional state-specific or system-specific requirements that you'll want to consider. So getting into OM&M, and our second big question, is the vapor intrusion mitigation system still working? We want to make sure that on a periodic basis that our vapor intrusion mitigation system is continuing to meet the performance metrics. You can use the OM&M checklist to assist with those periodic inspections and to measure the operational parameters. And you can use that to evaluate the performance and the potential for getting to the exit strategy. Is it time to execute and go to the exit strategy? But you may find as you're collecting these data, as you're monitoring, that your vapor intrusion mitigation system might not be meeting your performance metrics. So what do you do then? We really want to start off by analyzing the data to understand, if you can, the cause of the malfunction in your vapor intrusion mitigation system. You want to inform stakeholders. Even if you don't have a solution or you don't have an answer to why there's a malfunction, you want to let people know that you've identified it and that you're taking action to correct it. You'll want to eventually repair or replace malfunctioning equipment if that's applicable to your scenario. You may want to make changes in your site or building conditions. You know, one thing we keep talking about is that HVAC systems can have an impact on the performance of an active mitigation system. So do we need to make changes in our HVAC, add in fresh air feeds or additional pressure, for instance? And we might want to consider upgrading our vapor intrusion mitigation system itself or installing an additional system. Maybe one system's not enough. Maybe we have a passive system and now we need to move to an active system, for instance. And like I said, we want to keep in mind too that as we're looking at these data, we're assessing to see if we have that potential for terminating our vapor intrusion mitigation system. And for a moment, I want to talk a little bit more about our fact sheets and how our process fact sheets are laid out. We have these fact sheets for design, post-installation, OM&M, and exit strategy. And very early in the document, we've got these tables, which are intended to be a very quick resource to look at some different, in this case, we've got the design considerations here, to look at some of the major categories and considerations on the left-hand side of this chart. And across the top, we look at the different mitigation types. And we're ranking these by the Harvey balls that you see in the table, where we're saying that for each one of these subject matters and in each one of these mitigation types, the subject matter has either a high, medium, low impact, or it's not applicable to those mitigation types, so that someone can get very quickly a understanding of what are the key things that they need to think about as they're going through, in this case, design. But we don't leave you there. We don't leave you with just a summary table and say, go figure it out on yourself. Further in the document, we get into the detail. So in this case, if we're looking at subgrade soil type, we can see that it has a very high impact for an active approach, but really a low impact for a passive approach. So we discuss that further. You know, first on the right, you see what do we mean by subgrade soil type? And Catherine mentioned it for the active systems, and I think there was a knowledge check on it for the active systems. So what are we talking about there? Why does it matter? Why does it have such a high impact for an active system? And then why, conversely, does it have such a low impact on the passive mitigation system? So that's how we've tried to give you a very quick look at each one of these and then also a detailed look within the document. And these are our checklists that we have available. Looking through some of the checklists where we've got the system design and documentation, post-installation system verification, OM&M. We've tried to make these very straightforward. We also have one for conceptual site models where, like I said, you can take these out into the field. They're clickable checkboxes. They're editable fields. They're things that if you have, you know, electronic technology with you in the field, you can tap, you can click, you can write on them while you're out in the field. You can also edit them so that you know where you have state and site specific conditions. You can add that into the checklist and continue to use it for your site specific and state specific needs. And to talk a little bit about the layout, we've got the categories, we've got a primary prompt for the field staff to answer, we've got a spot to record supporting information, and then we've got these conditional or secondary prompts that are really follow-on questions that relate to the questions that are above. And in terms of our OM&M checklist, again, it's a field-ready checklist for active, passive, and remediation systems for continuing operation verification. And like I said, you can add in state-specific, site-specific needs and modify it however fits your specific site. So getting into the last big question, is your vapor intrusion system still needed? We want to plan for our exit strategy very early on. We keep saying this, and I'm going to keep going over it because it is critical, and a lot of folks miss this. A lot of folks don't think about it until further off in the process when it's a lot more difficult to define what is the appropriate condition for shutdown. And it's something that all stakeholders really should agree upon. And well before post-installation, well before monitoring, but we want to make sure that all of those procedures are laid out as part of that original design process. And so as we're continually evaluating our vapor intrusion mitigation system for meeting those exit conditions, we want to think about it not only during the OM&M events, but also when there's a significant site condition change. You know, for instance, have we remediated the site? Are we getting a lot less mass out of the ground if we have a soil vapor extraction system, for instance? So we've remediated it. Maybe our vapor intrusion mitigation system is no longer needed. And we want to make sure that as we're considering system shutdown, that we're really talking about how is that system going to be decommissioned? How do we actually shut it off? What do we do with the instrumentation, the piping, whatever it is? Some of that might be specified in a regulatory document. And I'll also acknowledge that there are certain sites that may never be shut down. So we want to think about it anyways, even if we don't expect that system to be shut down. But I don't want to give you the impression that every single system will be shut down, because I think there are some that probably won't get shut down, at least in our lifetimes. So here's our second knowledge check of the module and our final knowledge check, I'll say. Which is the most important post-installation verification measure? Most important. Is it vacuum field or pressure differential across the slab? Is it smoke or tracer gas testing? What about indoor air or soil gas sample results? How about long-term institutional controls or system vacuum and airflow? Or does it depend? Does it depend on a variety of factors? And I'll let you choose which one is the most important out of this list. Okay, what does everybody think? So we've got 66, two-thirds of you selected it depends. And that means a third selected some of those other verification measures. So let's see what the group thought here. Well, the group thought, or I should say the vapor intrusion mitigation training team thought it depends. And really what that goes to is it depends on your site. It depends on the system that you've installed, and it might even depend on regulatory requirements. Again, one of the things that we keep talking about is there are state-specific requirements to look into. There could be permit requirements to look into. And so it really depends on some of those specific factors. And it also might depend on using the multiple forms of verification that we talked about. There may not be one that's most important. There may be two of them or three of them that may be most important to verify that your system's working. So in summary, in this training module, for this section, we really discussed some of the key concepts from the post-installation and the OM&M process, exit strategy, fact sheets, and checklist. We stressed planning and figuring out your exit strategy early on and upfront, and continuing that through post-installation and OM&M. it's really beginning with the end in mind. We talked about commissioning and really confirming that that vapor intrusion mitigation system is operating as it was intended and is meeting those mitigation objectives using multiple forms of validation or testing. Talked about monitoring, continually evaluating if the vapor intrusion mitigation system is operating as it was intended and determining when that exit strategy could be implemented. And speaking of exit strategy, we're thinking about, are we at that point of turning off or discontinuing our system? And we're also thinking too about, do we need to reevaluate the exit strategy with our stakeholders? Do we need more communication with them if things aren't necessarily going the way we expect, or if we've reached another milestone that would require or be helpful to reconsider the exit strategy? And lastly, I'll say, if you have forgotten all of the things that I said here today, just really keep in mind those three simple questions about vapor intrusion mitigation systems. Is it working? Is it still working? And is it still needed?
All right. Thank you, Keith. With that, we will do our final question and answer portion of today's training, and then we will wrap up and send everybody off on their way. So I'll jump right into this last Q&A and read the questions in the pod. So the question that we have been punting has finally has come its time. How can we confirm that a building's air is clean and or free of contaminants?
I hope I answered that a bit when I was going through the slides here, but just to recap that quickly, it's not a straightforward answer, right? You can collect samples of indoor air, you can understand what contaminants are in indoor air or not indoor air, but as it relates to vapor intrusion mitigation systems, that is not going to be the only way that you'll say, a lot of times, it's not going to be the only way that you'll verify whether the system's working or not, because we're always looking at what are the sources of indoor air contamination as well that don't come from vapor intrusion. As I mentioned, if this shirt's dry cleaned, we'll pick up the dry cleaning chemicals in those indoor air tests. So we're not going to be able to say, you know, we're not going to use that as one, the sole source of verifying that our vapor intrusion mitigation system's actually working.
Great. Thanks so much, Keith. Next question. What frequency of testing and or monitoring is recommended?
I think that really depends on what your system is, what you've installed. And I think a lot of times it depends on the jurisdiction that you're in. I think different states have different requirements as to when they want to see monitoring. I say a lot, it ranges. In sites that I've seen, there are daily monitoring early on. There could be weekly after that. And as things are stabilizing, you might move to monthly and even in annual monitoring.
Yeah, I was just going to add to what you're saying, Keith. I think some of it depends on not only that, but the contaminant in the original concentration too, right? And Kelly might pop on as well too from another state's perspective, but I think you got to look at it site by site, right? There's some, I think you hit it on the head, where probably more frequent in the beginning till you know something's working or the concentrations have been reduced, and then some kind of tailoring off is probably as generalized as I can be without saying every quarter is appropriate, every half year, you know, because every state's going to be a little different.
Right.
And one other add, just to circle back to one of the other questions that was asked in terms of remote sensing or telemetry. Sometimes we'll add telemetry to a system in order to maybe reduce the number of physical visits to a site if you're able to, you know, go onto a user interface and see a couple of the key parameters of a system running. So that's another consideration for the question of frequency.
Yeah, I think too, in general, most states look at it that if you can get to the point that there's some other indicator parameters that would indicate or align that you have good indoor air, that you can reduce it, right, even further. So again, if you're showing possibly good vacuum, like when we're talking SSDs, if you have good vacuum underneath it and that you've been maintaining it consistently and that when you have good vacuum, you have low concentrations, there's reasons to even reduce it even further.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So with that, it looks like all of our questions have been answered. So I will just go about wrapping up the class here today. I would just like to say a thank you to all of our expert trainers for joining us today and making the training possible. And I would also like to thank all of our attendees for taking the time to join us today for session 2. And we hope to see you for future online webinars. ITRC has 2 left in June. 1,4-dioxane on June 8th and microplastics on June 13th. We encourage you to check those out before we take our summer hiatus from training. We would love to hear back from everybody in terms of how the course went today. I did put the link for the feedback form in the chat for everybody, so feel free to check that out and fill it out to also obtain a certificate of completion for today's course. If you would like any further clarification on any questions or answers provided today, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Their information is included on the Clue-In training page that brought you here today and on the slide deck that is also on the Clue-In training page. So if you have any questions, feel free to get in touch with us and we would be happy to help you out. So with that, I'm just going to wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and I hope that we will see you again for another training.
Thank you.
Thank you, trainers.